6, verse 9, and it says, these are the offspring of Noah. Then it says, Noah was a righteous man. He was complete, he was complete in his generation, and he walked, and Noah walked with God. And the next verse says that Noah gave birth to three sons, Shem, Ham, and Yafes. Okay? So the question that Rashi is bothered with is, it starts, this is the offspring of Noah, and then it says all the qualities of Noah. Doesn't say his offspring until the next verse. But it says he was a tzaddik, he was righteous, he was complete in his generation, he was he walked with God. Okay? Right, Rashi gives two answers. Okay, so the question is, why did he mention his praise, Noah's praise, before he said who the children was, since the statement is these are the children, offspring of Noah, should have stated them right away. So Rashi has two answers. One is, since the Torah mentions him, mentions Noah, so it tells his praise, because it says in a verse, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, the mention of a righteous person is for a blessing. And another explanation of the verse is to teach you that the essential offspring, or the main offspring of a tzaddik, of a righteous person, are his good deeds. Okay? So Rashi gives two different answers, and the question is, what do they mean? Okay, the question is that how did Noah connect with God? By Abraham, it says that that God approached Abraham. Here it doesn't say about God approaching Noah till later, and it says that Noah, and it just says that he was a righteous man. How did he become righteous? The answer is that God does not approach a person unless he is righteous. Okay? So Abraham was righteous before God approached him. And through Abraham on his own, through the universe, through the study of through the study of physics, so of the times that he had, so he found God. The Midrash puts it in a very interesting way. It says he was a little boy of 3 years old, and he looked out and he saw the sun dominates everything. So he thought the sun was God. But then at night, the moon pushed away the sun. So he thought the moon was God. Then the next day, the sun takes it away, right? So he says there must be something above both of them. But what the Midrash is saying, that if you study the universe, you will find God. That's the way the Midrash expresses itself in these type of stories, that through the study of the universe, you will find God. And as you get that knowledge of God, and you get closer and closer to God, at a certain point, God can relate to you. Okay? So therefore, both Abraham and Noah went through, must have gone through this process. Noah must have, Noah somehow went through this process. Exactly, I don't know. He might have heard it from Adam, you know, through the different generations passed on, or he, I don't know. It doesn't say how Noah got his righteousness. The pasuk, we looked up the pasuk in Mishlei, it's chapter 10, verse 7, and it says, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, you should mention a righteous for blessing, and the Rashi here in Noah says that a blessing means praise, and then the second half of the verse says, V'shem Rishom Yirkov, and the name of the wicked should rot. Okay? Right. Now what does it mean, rot? Means that you shouldn't mention it, just let it, like rot, you just let it go, it'll disappear. Don't deal with it, it'll just disappear. Right? Now the question is, that is not a correct opposite. What it should have said, and the name of the wicked, you should give disgrace to. You should talk bad about it. It doesn't say that. It says, and the name of the wicked you should let rot. Means don't mention his name. Don't disgrace him. Just don't mention him. Let him disappear. Okay? It's not the opposite of the first if. It should say disgrace. Right? That is the question. Alright, so I'd like to say like this, that the reason why you give praise of the righteous is so that people should identify with the righteous person. A certain identification. And that will cause people to want to be righteous. Okay? But when you degrade the wicked, what happens is, the human being, the unconscious of the human being is divided into two parts, his conscience and his animalistic part of him, you see? So when you use the conscience, it doesn't mean you got rid of the animalistic part, you just repressed it. So if we disgrace the wicked, what you'll do is you'll repress the your feelings of doing wicked things. That's all. But you don't get rid of it. You see? The correct way of removing evil is not by disgracing the evil, but through education of showing the consequences of evil. When you show the consequences of evil, then people see that it's worthless. So then the mind makes the decision, not the conscience. If you only control it through the conscience, like, this is bad, this is no good, so then the child represses the evil, but the child, or any person, will repress the evil, but they'll still have the evil with them, and it could come out at any time. But however, correct education demands that you educate about the consequences and don't mention. You only use the story of the wicked to show the consequences, what occurred to them. The stories of the wicked are only there to show you the consequences. Okay? That's what the verse is saying. It's a matter of education that with the righteous you should, is a positive thing. You should identify with the righteous. When you identify with the righteous, then you'll try to operate like the righteous through study Torah. You'll see that he studies, and you'll try and study, and you'll be like him. And then, but the wicked, the way you should get rid of evil is by showing them the consequences or contradictions to the life of evil. There are many contradictions in the life of evil, but just showing that it's not a reality. Those are the... That's why Shlomo HaMelech, therefore King David, did not write opposites, because the answer is not the opposite when you're trying to teach people. The question that Ruth is asking is that when you say that you should educate a person through the consequences of evil, so that doesn't mean rot. Rot means that the name just disappears. You see? The name just disappears. So the question is, really, it's a contradiction to Torah, because the Torah talks about evil people, and they mention the evil people. So here what the Torah is reminding of us of evil people, and here the verse is telling us that it should rot. You see? And yet, if the way we're explaining it also doesn't answer the question, because Ruth says that rot means that the name just disappears, meaning not to mention it at all. In other words, we're saying that it should not be forgotten, the evil person. We just shouldn't disgrace him. We should show the consequences. But according to the verse that it says that it should rot, seems to be that you shouldn't mention him at all until he is forgotten. Now, everybody knows Haman, everybody knows Esav, you know what I mean? We know all these evil people because of the Torah itself. So Ruth is saying the whole thing is contradictory. In other words, insofar as logic is concerned, we made a good distinction between the first half and the second half. But Ruth's question is the wording does not fit in. The wording doesn't fit into the explanation. I mean, the explanation does not fit into the wording. That is the problem. Right? Whenever you talk about something, you must recognize the context that it's in. For example, if people say that you're not allowed to work on Shabbos, right? But they say, well, putting the light on and off is not considered work. You see? Their mistake is that the word work is defined by the context that it's in. For instance, physical work is blinking your eyes. Your heart is beating. You're doing physical work. I mean, then if that's what the Torah meant, then you're violating the Shabbos. Psychologically, your child could go out and play football for 5 hours, but if you ask them to take out the garbage, that's too much trouble. Okay? So psychologically, there's certain times called work. You see? The halacha has a different definition of work. It's called creativity. You're creating something new. Put on a light, something new. Planting. All the 39, except going from one of them, was going from one place to another place. A public domain to a private domain. Or vice versa. But the thing is that the word work is defined by the context that it's in. Okay? Now the context that this subject is in, it's in praise. Praise. The word praise and disgrace, right? Insofar as praise and disgrace is concerned, you see, you should let them rot. Insofar as the opposites are concerned, praise and disgrace, right? Insofar as disgrace is concerned, in that context of the subject of praise and disgrace, you see, that in that way you should let it ride. You see? But however, insofar as education is concerned, that's a different category. In that category, you should remember the real wicked. You see? You understand? In other words, in the category of praising or disgracing, in other words, like when you disgrace somebody publicly, so, not to embarrass them, if the guy is even dead, you understand? But to try to get somebody not to do evil, the Torah is saying, no, that you should let it rot. That way you should let it rot. Because that will bring out a certain harm, because you're allowing the evil to fester, and it's only controlled by through repression. You see? But however, how you should remember the wicked, how you should remember the wicked is through consequences. Cal mentioned that in the laws of Lashon Hara, Even you're not allowed to tell it over if nobody knows about it. But once 3 people know about it, then you're allowed to tell it over for educational purposes, but not just to tell it over. It's the same type of distinction as we have here. Yes, that is correct. Right. So therefore, we're back to Noach. The first answer is saying that you should always make people identify with the greatness and goodness of a tzaddik. And therefore, so even though once they mention Noach, even though the subject is his offspring, but when you're talking about a tzaddik, even though the subject is his offspring, you should immediately mention his qualities of righteousness, and so that you should identify with him and do the same. Okay? While the second answer says that the reason why it says his qualities first is to tell you that is the main offspring or the essential offspring of a person, more important than his children. Okay? The question is, I'd like to hear some explanation for it. Hey, the question is, why do I think it's such a powerful statement? Is because we're saying that your righteousness, who you are, should be more important. You should have more attachment to that than to your children. In other words, you should hold that your righteousness is a greater product than the produce of your children, than producing children. That's a greater product. Okay? And the question is why? So Cal wants to answer that the benefit of your own personality is that you live a certain type of life that will model justice, and then that will affect your children. So according to Cal, the children are still more important, and the only reason why you should have these righteous qualities is because of your children. I don't think that's what the verse is saying. You know what I mean? I think the verse is saying, no, the quality itself is more important than the children. Cal just says that it's just a side effect. One of the benefits of it is that it will affect your children. But however, Cal is not saying that that's the essential point here. Okay? So therefore, we still need to find the essential point. Why is your personality, insofar as being righteous is concerned, and perfecting your soul, more important, a greater produce, a greater product than your children? The question is that, of course, yourself should come first, right? But in reality, if you stop and look at it, when you talk Lashon Hara, how bad do you feel? But if your child broke his arm, how bad do you feel? I mean, you feel worse. I mean, you feel worse by the, when something goes wrong with your child than anything evil that you could do. Okay? And a lot of parents stick by their children even when they are evil. You know what I mean? So you see that the children is more important than any level of justice. In reality, that's what it's like. Now, to want to live the life of justice, and that it should be more important than the child, then you have to have some reason for that. Just first of all, to know why, and secondly, how are you going to counteract the love of the child, and to have righteousness greater than the love of a child? How are you going to counteract that? Before we said, when we're learning the Pasuk and Mishlei, that just the Torah telling you that your life should be better, that's not going to help. I mean, what's going to help is where you see the ideas. That changes your life. But just because the Torah says so, that affects you very little. It affects you to a certain extent. But the real benefit is where the mind sees why the Torah says so. Okay? Ruth made an observation, really an interesting observation. And that is that many times we do injustice because of our children. In other words, first of all, sometimes a child needs reprimand and you overlook it. Sometimes a child needs a compliment. For some reason, you get tough on them, or you don't. Or sometimes a child knows how to manipulate the parent. They manipulate the parent. They can manipulate the parent to do something wrong. So therefore, the love of the child can affect your very justice. That is really a very interesting point. That's very interesting. Yes, you're right. It happens quite often. But it's a beautiful observation. Beautiful observation. Another example of that is that when your child gets into a fight, you just automatically think that your child is right without investigating the facts. You know what I mean? And you just condemn the other child. That is that could be unjust too. I understand that if you don't live a rational life, there are consequences. I understand. There are consequences. But the thing is that there are consequences for my children. You have to tell me why I should want to live. My righteousness should be more important than my children. The reason why we can't see the answer is because the power of this emotion. It's a very, very powerful emotion, and it's very, very hard to get out of it. Very hard to get out of it. But the answer is very, very simple. My relationship to my child, it should not be based on my emotional. That's what Ruth pointed out before, that it should not be based on the emotional, but it should be based on a system of justice. You see? In other words, my life, how I relate to my child, that's not the essence. The essence is who I am. If I identify with this psychologically with the child, it means the child is an extension of me. And that child is really not an extension of you except biologically. I'll tell you why. Because psychologically you're made up of two parents, and you had two different parents than your child. So psychologically they could be different. And psychologically they are a different person. But the mind the mind identification is a false view of life. You see, it's a false view of life because identification says you are me, and therefore I relate to you like I would relate to me. And where it's a child, the identification is so powerful that I relate to you better than I relate to me. The relationship starts from the reason why it's so powerful is because it starts from a total fantasy relationship. The relationship is not real. It's based on a fantasy that doesn't exist. This child, the first thing that a person has to recognize is this child is not me. There's a different human being. It's a different human being. Even that idea is a very difficult idea for the emotions to accept. We don't want to see that. Therefore, if it's a different human being, then justice demands that I deal with it according to justice. You see? It's a different relationship. Justice tells me that this child has nobody else to depend on. So I have to do everything I can to help this child. Nobody else is going to take care of the child the way I can, because that's the way it is. So because it's my responsibility to take care of the child. It's a different relationship with the child. There's a love of the child, but the love of the child should not affect your relationship with the child, how you relate. I'm not saying you shouldn't love your child, but I'm just saying you should make sure that the love of the child does not affect who the child is. And many times that emotion brings out rebellion because you want to control the child and force the child to live a certain life. The child senses that and rebels, you see. But it would be much better where you look at the child and look at the child as justice. In other words, a person must recognize that his life, the first thing a person must recognize is that he is here. His whole purpose is here to perfect his soul. Okay? And the perfection of the soul, and you are the most important person in the world. You must perfect your soul. That is your relationship with the God. There is nothing more important in this world than your relationship to God. That is your life. That's your benefit. That is the benefit of who you are. You see? So therefore, once you look at it that way, then the child, even though you do have a love for the child is secondary because the child is just a matter of a result of that justice of my relationship to God. It's a matter of my relationship to God demands that I do justice. I must do what is best for this child. And therefore, I must think through. For a person that does justice thinks through, just like a person that goes to business, spends his life working out all types of strategy of making money or how to cheat people. He spends his time thinking how to cheat people, put people down. A man of justice spends his life in working out the best way of helping others. And therefore, this child who cannot depend on anybody else, so therefore he'll work out the best way of raising his child. He'll understand how to raise a child in the best manner and the best form. And therefore he'll do that which is best for the child. You see? But the thing is, the essence of a person's life is shouldn't be based on fantasy. But the essence of a person's life should be based on reality, and that is your relationship to God. That's the essence of your life. Ruth again asks, but I said, let's, before I said, I always want to see the practical, let's leave God out. When I talk about God, I mean the life of Torah. It's the life of Torah which is the best possible life that a human being could have. And each person has free will. I have that free will, my child has that free will, and I can't take away that free will from my child. I can only do that which is best for that child. You see? When I talk about God, I talk about the best possible life that a human being could have. You see? I talk about the life of Torah, which is the best possible life. That must have priority. I know it's a very difficult thing. A person might never reach that level. You understand? But that is the direction which a person has to go towards to reach that direction, that their total life should be the life of Torah. Then everything else fits into the life of Torah. How much should I do for my wife? My wife will think about how much should I do for my husband and the family. And then how should I work for my children? Because that's a system of justice. The family is itself a system of justice. So therefore I must work what my job in the family is. What my wife has to think about what her job in the family is. And then how we raise our children must be worked out in a rational system. You see, because we live the life of justice. But relating to a child through identification is just a fantasy that this child is an extension of me. You know, it's, you know, that's just not true. It's just not true. Once the child is born, it's a individual. It's just that it needs help. So therefore, because of justice, you are obligated to help. Of course, if we did not have identification and we relied on justice practically to do for our children, most children would die before we reach that level. Okay? But the fact is, that's probably why God created that fantasy of identification through that our children exist. But I'm saying simultaneously that we raise our children that way, and it is a good, and we do the best for the children that we can, simultaneously we have the responsibility to change and to recognize that that we should develop towards an independent person, and our children will sense that and become more independent themselves because they recognize they're independent people, and you'll be able to let them loose when it's time to let them free, and you won't hold on too tight or whatever, you know what I mean? You won't go to extremes because of your identification with your child. The question is, it's not clear how I've proven that my life comes first, okay? Because I'm saying that the reason why the child comes first is based on a false, unconscious fantasy relationship with that child. And that is, that child is an extension of me. That child is me. And when that child does something wrong, I get embarrassed. If the child walks out of the house not dressed the way I think a child should be, I'm embarrassed. Why? It would be no different as if I walked out the way my child is walking out. My child does something bad, it's not because it's evil, because I would feel embarrassed doing that act. It's based on a totally false relationship. That child is not you. that child, I mean, you brought the child into existence, but now it's a different human being. You see? You must change from the fantasy relationship with your child to a realistic relationship to a child. I do say that is better, but it's not the reason why you do it. You do it because you want to live a realistic life, and the realistic life is the best life to do. And once you realize that justice is part of the realistic life, and you understand how far you must go for justice, then you will raise your child 100% correctly. But not because of the identification, but because of the idea of justice. And the question is, the question that Doug asked is that it's true that I put the child first because of identification, okay? But he says, but don't I put the child first also because of justice? The answer is, the reason why I do justice is because that is the benefit to me. So the whole thing, justice doesn't mean I shouldn't do for others and sometimes put my life second to them, even not to your children, even to other people. Justice sometimes means not you don't put your life on the line, but the thing is that you give up a large part of your time and energy to help others. You give money to help others. That is part of justice. But the reason why I do justice is because it's a benefit to me. Now, the child is just the result of my justice. But that's a realistic relationship to the world. But if I relate to my child through identification, then I'm not relating to the world correctly. And in particular, my child. Let me put it another way. You could do this time, you could make a change by undoing the identification. If you're able to break that identification, the idea of identification altogether, then I think automatically you would think this way. You would not have a problem thinking this way. It's only the reason why I have difficulty thinking this way is because you still look at the world through identification and how you relate to people. A friend is just somebody you identify with. It's just not as strong as a child. That's all, but it's all identification. Who you like and who you don't like is based on identification. You see? But the thing is, once you remove the idea of identification in general, then I think this type of life is no problem at all. I mean, you naturally move to the life of justice. That would take its place automatically. So back to Rashi, okay? So Rashi, when it says, the question was that these are the offsprings of Noah, and then it mentions the righteousness of Noah and not the children first, there are two possible answers. One is, it's a benefit to others, okay? It's a benefit to others that you mention the... So as soon as, whenever you mention a tzaddik, automatically part of that mention, whatever the subject is, you should always mention praise, okay? So that people could identify that's part of your justice to other people, you see? Or, the reason why it mentions justice first is because there's two offsprings, there's two things that you create. You create your personality, that's free will. Free will is creating a new personality, or you create a new being. Both of them are offsprings. So he's saying that the reason why they mention the first offspring, namely his justice, his personality, is because that is the main offspring, which Rashi actually says, that is the main offspring, the secondary offspring are the children. If the question was that is that why we praise God, is so that we should identify with God? The answer is no, because if we identify with God, then we're looking at God through ourselves, which means we're looking at God physically. That would be idolatry. So therefore, when you remove identification, okay, then you can... You would you would have the good life, and then you would truly relate to God because you would remove that quality of identification, which would lead to God to be physical, which would be idolatry. So removing identification is a good... in other words, the only place that you should use identification is with the righteous, so as to, and that's why they put it here, as long as you have that identification, you should identify with the righteous, so you should want to live the life of the righteous and to try to operate like the righteous as best you can, so that you should have this type of life. And at a certain point, you could remove the identification, and then you could relate to God's... then everything would be based on pure logic, not the identification. It says in verse 9 of chapter 6, it says, this is the offspring of Noah. Noah was a righteous and perfect in his generation. So Rashi says there's a difference of opinion what it means in his generation. There are those among our rabbis who expound this word as praise. Therefore, all the more... in other words, it says in his generation, so certainly if he had been in a generation of righteous people, he would have even been more righteous. And there are those that expound or interpret as a degradation or deprecation. They say like this: according to the standards of his generation, he was righteous. But if he was in the generation of Abraham, he would not have been considered anything of significance. Okay? Alright, what Rashi is saying is that there's two ways of interpreting his generation. There's two possible implications. It's his generations he was righteous, but in another generation where they would be more righteous, he would have been even greater. Or, in other words, in his generation, but certainly in other generations. The other implication, he was great in his generation, but he wouldn't have been great in, let's say, Abraham's generation. He wouldn't have been considered great. Okay? So the question is, what does that mean? I mean, either he's righteous or he isn't righteous. What does it mean that he would have been greater, he could have been greater, or he could have been worse? I mean, he is what he is. I mean, what is Rashi saying about Noah? In other words, it's a very nice deduction which Rashi made, the two deductions, but however, what does that tell us about Noah? Is he telling me something about Noah, or he's just made some nice deductions? So the answer is there are two possibilities. The environment definitely affects who you're going to be. If you're raised in a society of science and studies, so then that'll bring out your potential greater than if you're raised on a farm with no learning and no books and no study. I mean, even you could be a genius, but however, there's nothing to bring out your genius. You might be very sharp in the everyday life and things, but your mind will not develop in that situation. Your mind cannot develop in certain situations. And certainly Noah, who was raised in a generation where it says later on that there was all... it says before too that it was all pleasure. It was a life of pleasure. The life of pleasure is not conducive to a world of thought. However, by Noah lived, I think, around 70 years after the Tower of Babel, and the Tower of Babel there they were thinkers. They were evil, but they were, you know, they worked on. They were architectures and builders, and which had to be thought out and worked out. They might have been evil, but however, they were thinkers. That generation, in that type of atmosphere, person could become a thinker. In other words, Abraham must have been raised in a society where they were, at least in the sciences, they weren't righteous. What Abraham did is he pulled out and found the world of God and ideas. Ideas about God and ideas of truth and justice. Which they didn't have in those days. While in Noah's time, it was a life of pleasure and immediate enjoyment, so you're not going to develop the mind in that situation. So even though he pulled out and he was able to start thinking about God, but however, it stunted his growth because of the atmosphere that he was in. That's one side. The other side is that he could have been greater even in his generation, but the only thing is he just didn't have the ability. And so therefore, in his generation, he was righteous because even though he didn't have the ability compared to those people, he was great. But if he was in Abraham's time compared to Abraham, you wouldn't have heard of him. You wouldn't have even heard of him because he simply didn't have the ability. Even if he was raised in a situation where it was conducive to learning, he wouldn't have been great. You just wouldn't have heard about him. The question is what is the point of saying the second possibility in Rashi, which puts down Noah? What is the, and I mean, it's an interesting possibility, but what was the purpose of it? Okay. The first thing is that the Torah is extremely honest about their leaders. And if there is a fault, the Torah is honest enough to say, look, we don't have saints. We just have people, and this is a possibility, a logical possibility, that this is Noah, that he reached his potential, and he couldn't reach any other, but he couldn't go greater than that. It is a possibility. So Rashi mentions that possibility. We always mention the weaknesses of we point out their good points, and we point out their weaknesses. Okay? That's part to educate us, that everybody makes mistakes, and you also have to learn from your mistakes and keep developing, even though these great people, or maybe you can't get, or there's a certain point where you have to accept yourself. In other words, it's one of the two. Either you're not trying hard enough, or at a certain point, you have to accept yourself. This is a decision every human being has to make. You make a mistake. Let's say, for instance, you don't have the capability to push yourself forward, you'll be frustrated the rest of your life. If you do have the ability and you don't push, you're lazy. You could have developed yourself to a higher level. So therefore, a person must always evaluate. And I think that's what Rashi is bringing out. A person must evaluate constantly where he's, who he is. And that evaluation could change as you find more information about yourself. It could change. So either at a certain point you accept yourself, or at a certain point you say, I'm too lazy, I better move on. You see? So that's why Rashi, I believe, is saying both possibilities. Okay? But insofar as Noach is concerned, insofar as Noach himself is concerned, we always tell, you know, who they were. What are the possibilities? Or if we don't know the 100% truth what they were, then we mention the possibilities. That's what Rashi did. He says there are two possibilities. When we talk about potential, we're talking about insofar as your knowledge of God is concerned. The potential in profession or how much money you're going to make, that the Torah is not interested in. The Torah is only interested in those people that related to God. Those people that didn't relate to God, then we tried to point out what their nature was. So you should know the nature of the Eitz Hara, the evil inclination. In other words, through them you recognize, because they were extreme, so it's easy to recognize the nature of evil, and so therefore you could protect yourself from it. You don't know the nature of evil, you can't protect yourself. So therefore, they pointed out evil, and they pointed out the mistakes of the righteous. And many times it says how God acted towards them when they did make mistakes, and how it benefited them. But here, Rashi, where it says that he was righteous in his generation, there are two logical possibilities. And every person has to accept who they are. Either they're in any decision about yourself, either you could do more or you reach your potential. You don't know which it is you're going to pay the price. Because either you'll be lazy or you'll strive for something you can't accomplish. I mean, even in your potential, I mean, certain people can work 2 hours a day in thought, and they can't anymore. They can't anymore. Some people can work 18 hours a day, and it doesn't bother them. They just continue on. You have to know. If you can only operate for 2 hours and you try and push yourself 8 hours, you just your mind is going to not work at its potential, and you're just frustrating yourself because you can't do it. But if you could do 8 hours and you only do 2 hours, then you're just lazy and you're not fulfilling your potential insofar as your relationship to God is concerned. Okay. Insofar as God correcting the Noah, he can't because it's not his fault. In other words, if it was his potential, then that's the way it is. That's all. God doesn't change a person's potential. And insofar as he could have been greater in a different generation. That God only affects where your personal, where your emotions, your psyche, where your personality affects your thinking process. That area is the only area that I've seen where God intervenes to help you. But if it's the laws of nature, God doesn't intervene in those areas. In other words, especially when it comes to the mind, because God doesn't intervene insofar as free will is concerned. Like there's sages that say, everything is in the hands of heaven except the fear of heaven. You see, the fear of heaven is where free will is. God does not intervene. God would have to intervene in his free will in both these cases. And God draws the line. It is free will that I say, except in rare cases, and all the commentaries question why in those rare cases he does. Okay? But the thing is that in general, he does not intervene in free will. So therefore, these two things have to do with free will. That's it. So it has to do with his mind. He doesn't interfere with the mind. You have to understand God's relationship to either great person or to Israel is a system. It's not just like how I feel. It's a system how God relates to us. And therefore, you have to know, in other words, and here is knowledge of how the system works. That God could interfere in any part of your life except your free will. And where he does intervene, he sets up a situation, and where he does intervene, he sets is only where your emotions, or your psyche, or your personality has affected your thinking process, then he sets up a situation in the physical world that will bring that out so the person can help himself. But God will not affect the free will itself. He creates a situation. But however, where a person is born with a certain potential, or his potential can't come about because he was born in a generation where it's not conducive to bring out all his potential, you see, God does not intervene in that type of situation. So that's knowledge of God's system. It says at the end of the verse, as Elohim is halach Noach. Noach walked with God. So Rashi says, and by Abraham, regarding Abraham, it says, he walked before me. Okay, here he walked with God, and here he walked before me. So Rashi explains, Noah needed support to bear him up, to hold him up. He needed support.
But Abraham was strengthened himself, and he walked in his righteousness on his own. He didn't need God's help. But Noah needed God's help. Okay? The question is, what is the difference between the two people? And the second question is how does God hold you up? How does he support you? Okay, like we said just before, he doesn't get involved in free will. So then how could he support you? There are two types of development insofar as righteousness is concerned. One development is that no matter what situation you're in, you'll never, it won't affect your ability to think correctly. The ultimate usually is like Rabbi Akiva. The Rabbi Akiva reached a point where he was tortured to death. Abraham, who loved his son very much, was given the test to slaughter his son. Okay? In other words, there isn't a situation where anything would come in that he does not relate to God correctly. There's nothing that would affect him. There's no situation that could take his mind off his true, that affects his true knowledge of God, where he's totally guided by the mind, and the mind tells him this is the way, and no matter what the situation is, he is still righteous. That was Abraham. There are certain people that are righteous, and they've reached a level that most situations they could live with. But every once in a while, there might be one or two situations that will affect them. That they can't get at them. And if they go in that situation, they will be affected. And there's nothing they could do. In other words, that's their potential. Their potential is to reach that level, and they can't go further. Okay? In that situation, then God makes sure that they do not fall into that situation. God will protect them. That's what it means. Noah walked with God. He walked with God. It means God will protect them to make sure that he will not allow a situation that will affect his righteousness, since there is nothing he himself can do to protect himself in that type of situation. Okay? It is very possible that God had many ways of bringing about the flood, protecting Noah. And here he made Noah build a ark for 120 years. Okay? Rashi later on says it was for the purpose of the people to do tshuva. But we also know that Abraham went out to the public, went to the people. Why couldn't Noah go to the people? I remember hearing, I don't know the story, but it is possible that it could be that also that he made Noah build the ark. It is possible because Noah, if he went out among the people, all their pleasures and enjoyment, and to try to talk to them there, he would have failed. As soon as he would have gotten to that situation, he would have failed. You see? The same thing, a person that's addicted. Sometimes you could undo your addiction, or sometimes you have to stay away from situations that awaken your addiction. You see? The same type of thing. The question is that does that prevent the person from growing or developing? Okay? The answer is no, because the thing is that he would have totally failed if he got into that situation. In other words, if he was ready for it, then God would have put him into it. He would have put him in that situation and forced him to deal with his emotion to straighten it out. But God recognized that he couldn't, so therefore he doesn't put him in, since he would have definitely failed. In other words, there's certain people that have addiction for their whole lives and they can't get out of it. The only way they can get out of it is by staying out of the situation. Certain situations. But however, there are there are certain people that they have to go into that situation, and they could fight it, and they have to train themselves to fight that situation. Depends who you are. That, as usual, in knowing who you are in any given area, is there's going to be mistakes. And a person that's aware of the different possibilities of who he is, and aware of this, so he will recognize when he made a mistake, where he went too far one way, when he should go back, or he went too far the other way, and he should come back this way, you understand? Where, and it's only through mistakes that you could look back and say, now I know, like experimentation. You have experimentation about different things. What a thing is. You want to know, so you know its quality, so you... In other words, like this, there are certain... Let's, for instance, take drinking like alcohol or something like that, or wine. Now, there's certain people we know that could become addicted, and there's certain people that could enjoy it. Now, the person that could enjoy it and not become addicted, if he gives it up, the question is, why should he give up a pleasure in life? And if a person could be addicted, then he should not touch it, right? So, therefore, since you have to make that type of evaluation, I say like this. A person that's not a chacham should not experiment, because you wouldn't know how. You have to know how to experiment and how to evaluate. It's like a scientist. You have to know how to evaluate. If you know how to evaluate, then you can start the experiment. But if you don't know how to evaluate, then you can't make the experiment, because you can't come out with the right conclusion. So therefore I say, in these type of experimentations, a person has to be a chacham. If not a chacham, if he doesn't know how to evaluate, then he's going to fail. In other words, a little more clarification. In other words, let's say, for instance, with cocaine, a person knows that that's a physical addiction that you should everybody stay away from. But insofar as drinking is concerned, some people can and some people can't. Now, if you're not a chacham and you don't know how to deal with problems, and you can become addicted to drink, then you could ruin your life. So therefore, if you're not a chacham, don't get involved in the experiment. You understand? Because if you don't, if you could ruin your life. So therefore, you have to go to the other extreme and stay away from it. But however, if you're a chacham, then you could try to experiment and you could recognize how to go and how to deal with it. Or if you get addicted, he'll know how to undo the addiction and to stay, and to deal with it. I just want to go back to Noah. There's certain challenges in the laws of nature. That everybody has. But where God intervenes in the laws of nature, then he will only challenge you if you have the ability to make it. If you don't have the ability to make it, then he will make sure that you will not be in a situation where you can't make it. But that's where God intervenes. But until then, a person must evaluate where he is in any type of given situation, whether he's going too far or not far enough. And that only a chacham could do, where you could evaluate quantity. Because all these things is not a qualitative difference. It's very hard to measure. You have to be scientific about it. Okay? So therefore, that's what I think the pasuk is talking about. We're up to verse 11. And it says, and the earth had become corrupt before God, and the earth had become filled with chamas. Okay? So the question is, and the word is vatishaches, corrupt, okay? So Rashi says, what does it mean, corrupt? So he says, is an expression of sexual immorality and idolatry. And he brings proofs from different pesukim. And it says, the earth was filled with chamas. He says, the word chamas comes from gazel, means robbery. And again, he brings a proof for this, that it's robbery. And robbery, okay. All right, so those are the facts. So the land became filled with sexual immorality, idolatry, and robbery. Okay. Then verse 12 says, and God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupted, for all flesh had corrupted its way upon the earth. So Rashi says, what does it mean, all flesh had been corrupted? What is all flesh? What do you mean by all flesh? So he says, even domestic animals, beasts, and birds had relations with those which were not of their own species. Okay? Well, the Medrash, in Medrash Rabbah, it says that Rabbi Zayir said in Rabbi Yehuda's name, all flesh means all acted corruptly in the generation of the flood. The dog copulated with the wolf, the fowl with the peacock. Hence it is written, for all flesh had corrupted their way. Reb Julian ben Tiberius said in Reb Isaac's name, even the earth acted lewdly. Wheat was sown, and it produced pseudo-wheat. For the pseudo-wheat we now find came from the age of the deluge. Or the deluge. Meaning that pseudo-wheat, according to the Jastro, means it means darnel or rye grass, and in the dictionary says, what is darnel or rye grass? It's a poisonous weed resembling rye, often found in grain fields. So that came from the time of the flood. Okay, that's what it is. So the question is, so why did God? That the fact that the animals acted incorrectly. I mean, they don't have free choice. I mean, what's the big deal? I mean, they just, well, what is the pasuk pointing out? So if you interpret it as the land, I mean, what is it pointing out to? You understand? I mean, what do I care? They don't have free will. Since the animals, Ruth wants to say that since the animals cannot change their style, or the earth cannot do it, it must have been some outside source that affected the animals and the earth. Okay? The question is, who is the outside source? But the only one that you could say that did this is the humans. You see? And we see this today also. I mean, humans bring animals into zoos where it's unhealthy. They're finding that a lot of animals do crazy things that they would never do in the wild. They bring in from other countries different types of animals or things that grow, and then it destroys what we have here. They destroy the human, the way they act and their haughtiness. They try to control everything, so they actually destroy the earth, if they don't know really what they're doing in their ignorance. They destroy the earth. So that's what was happening at that time. And later on, when God destroyed the animals, so it makes sense, because God will destroy. In other words, when God punishes in the destruction, it shows sometimes it shows the cause, and sometimes it shows the object which was used. He destroys the object with which they sinned. See? So he destroyed the animals because he destroyed the object with which they sinned. Okay? In other words, it sometimes shows the cause also. It could be because the human being, in other words, sometimes even science, there's two reasons for science, two motivations for science. One motivation for science is to control the physical world. Another motivation for science is to search the truth, you see? Now, once you have that motivation for control, so you start doing things which are really corrupt and incorrect. A person has to have when they try to change the physical world, there must be a certain amount of morals and ethics in the world. It's not only control. In other words, if you let control get out of hand, you see, so then you'll do things that totally destroy the physical world. You see? So there has to be certain morals and ethics, not just purely control, just because I have the power, therefore I'm going to do it. Even scientists, forget about the regular person, even scientists go that way. So therefore, that's what the Pasuk could be saying, that the nature of the people were that they had control. Because they had control, they acted upon it without thought, without the consequences, and without the morality and ethics that a person must have when he does these things. In other words, this Rashi that we're discussing is not telling us what the cause of the flood is. That we'll soon see. But however, it does tell us the nature of the people of the time. That they had no respect, that they had control, and therefore they just used the control. They didn't care about the results or the consequences of these things. And that's what our sages say, as a result of their experimentation at the time of the flood. He said in their time, in the time of the sages, they had this darnel or ryegrass, which is a poisonous thing. It looks like rye, and yet it's poisonous. This is what they created. Now today, in modern times too, we're creating things that are totally destructive, and we have no control over it. You understand? We have to have certain rules. I don't know the rules, but there has to be a way, a method of protecting ourselves, and the scientists have to get together and discuss it. In other words, the corruption of the people was, it's not the experimentation that's wrong. Experimentation is a good thing. But however, without any safeguards, you see, there are no safeguards. Without safeguards, the experimentation could destroy us. And it did. I mean, you see, even at the time, they say at the time of the flood, as they just say, that they created a poisonous type of weed. It looks like rye. You understand that today we're doing the same thing. We don't know what we're doing. Verse 13 says, and God said to Noah that the end of all flesh has come before me. And then he says, because the earth is filled with violence because of that. And I will destroy the land. So Rashi says, the end of all flesh. Says, any place where you find promiscuity, catastrophe comes to the world and kills both good and bad. And by the good, it seems to mean the children, okay? But the whole world was wiped out with the good and the bad. And the question is, why should, if it's in the laws of nature, so there's a certain amount of chance. But here God is intervening. Why did God kill out the good and the bad? Wipe out everybody. And Rashi says, in general, wherever you find promiscuity, you find catastrophe, and it kills both good and bad. And we'll come back to this question. The next Rashi says, for the earth is filled with the robbery. So Rashi says, this sentence was not sealed except on account of robbery. So the question is, in other words, they deserve death because of the promiscuity. But however, God wanted to destroy them for the promiscuity. The death came because of the robbery, not because of the promiscuity. Okay? So the question is why? Why is that true? Why didn't God kill them? Because of the promiscuity. Like he said in the first verse, because of the promiscuity, the good and the bad died. The Ramban seems to answer this question. In the same verse, verse 13 in Nachmanides, he says, violence, that is robbery and oppression. He calls chamas, the word chamas, robbery and oppression. Now God gave Noah the explanation that the flood was due to the fact that the earth is filled with violence and did not mention the corruption of the way recorded in the preceding verse, because violence is a sin that is known and widely publicized. And rabbis have said that it was on account of the sin of violence that their fate was sealed. The reason for it is that the prohibition against violence is a rational commandment, there being no need for a prophet to admonish them against it. The truth is that promiscuity, you stop to think about promiscuity, there's absolutely nothing wrong. What is wrong to people, you know, like for instance in the 60s, they said, look, as long as there's two consenting adults, what's the difference? As long as it's not forced, okay? So, that the only reason why we do not allow promiscuity is because through prophecy, because the Torah commands us and we shouldn't do it. That's a prophecy. But objectively, why would promiscuity be a problem? And also the question is, if God prohibited it, what is wrong with it that God should prohibit it? There's nothing wrong. In other words, whenever God prohibits something, there must be something wrong. Okay? So the question is, why did God prohibit it to begin with? The human being has a part of him that he is not aware of that affects him. For instance, there are people that have a terrible fear of the sight of blood. Now, the sight of blood cannot harm you. It gets you frightened of it. Or people get a shot. Now, well, you could play football and get banged up and it doesn't bother you, but you go to some people, they go get a shot, they go crazy. There's no blood, you know what I mean? Yet it can't be explained physically. There's no physical reason why it should happen. In other words, there's a part of you that you're not aware of, and why you feel certain feelings you're not aware of, but they affect you. They affect you. Okay? Now, this part of you does not make distinctions. It's irrational. It does not make distinctions. So once you give license to this part of you, then it just goes all the way. In other words, once you give license to this part of you, you notice, the question is, what sells today in movies and books? Two things. Violence and sex. You see, those are the good things. Why is violence and sex so exciting? You understand? The answer is, it's exciting. It goes way beyond reality. The draw of violence and sex, I mean, it just goes way beyond reality. See, that is a part. Those two are the main drives of that part of you, that part of you that is, you're not aware of, okay? And so therefore, when you give license to one, then the other one will come through too. You even see it in our own society. Our society started off by having sex as long as it's two consenting adults, right? And what happened? Today we have drive-by shootings, rape is up, murder is up, robbery is up, all these things are up. It's only been around 30, 40 years since they started it. Okay? And it was a certain, every generation, every decade, whatever it is, you see a big difference from before. You see? So once you give license to this part of you, you do not make distinctions and the other part comes out. Okay. So there, but however, since it is such a speck that it's very difficult to see on your own, so therefore we can't condemn the society of the flood for the promiscuity. Because they have no warning. And it's a big step to go from promiscuity to murder. Most people would never connect these things to violence. From promiscuity to violence, you see. So therefore, we couldn't, in other words, God already knew that they should be punished. because of the promiscuity. But however, he waited for the violence. Why? Because violence is something you see that is really harmful. That logic dictates. Now, once you do things that is harmful to yourself, which is totally destructive, how am I going to talk to you? The whole way a person could be talked to, be explained, is showing that it's self-preservation, that there's some benefit or some harm. In other words, you should do something because there's a benefit, you should not do something because there's a harm. But if you live your life in a harmful way, what could I tell you? You think the harm is the good. And you don't think, and you can figure it out yourself. Any human being can figure it out that a life of violence is just not healthy for anybody, even for the people that have the violence, and they just don't care. They just don't think about it. Because once it reaches that point, you say, then I can't help them. I can't help them, then they should be destroyed. You see, before that, when it's still promiscuity, so it's pleasure, so they could be stopped. So therefore, God told Noah, build the ark, and maybe we could help a few repent. But they didn't learn from that. You see, then when it started the violence, that's when God said, it's all over. Okay, they can't be helped. You see, that is what I believe Nachmanides is saying. He's saying that that would explain Rashi too. Okay? In other words, the question is, if they didn't know about promiscuity, so then why should they even be punished for promiscuity? Okay? First of all, some people do actions that the consequences, you don't realize the consequences, and there are consequences. Like, for instance, at one point, we didn't know that asbestos causes cancer. And people had asbestos all over the place, you see. So, but they still got the consequences, even though they're ignorant. Okay, that's one thing. And second, well, that was the purpose of Noah. Noah was supposed to tell them when he was building the ark. So he was supposed to tell them that, look, it's wrong in what you're doing. Try to show them, and there's going to be consequences to it. So I'm sure Noah had this type of conversation. This type of conversation when the people came to him. Now the question is, why is it when promiscuity causes a catastrophe, it kills both the good and the bad? Okay, that's the question. The thing is that if you see a certain pleasure and you don't see any consequence in it, would there be any reason not to partake of that pleasure? Of course you should partake of it. There's no reason, right? What if a whole society doesn't see the nature of a certain type of act that leads to a certain consequence, certain pleasure that would lead to a consequence if the society doesn't see it? So the parents will raise their children with that desire. In other words, they already are ingrained with a certain view. Children pick up a certain view from their parents, from people around them. They haven't done anything. They're too young. But however, the attitude of the parents they pick up. They pick up the attitude of the parents. That's why a society as a whole, sometimes the children are corrupted at a certain age already. You have to know what age. You understand, at a certain age, children become corrupted, and even though they haven't done anything wrong, their view of life is such that they will do things that are harmful to themselves. You see? So therefore, the thing is that a society that has a false view of life, and they think this false view of life is a good life, they raise their children that way. And their children pick up on this false view. You see? And at a young age, even though these children haven't done anything wrong, they're already corrupted in their ways. And it's only to God. I mean, we as humans cannot do anything about such a thing. But however, God, who is just and works out every single angle, he's the one that can. In other words, God could do to punish a society and destroy the children that already have been corrupted by the society. We can't. We can only, courts can only destroy somebody only when they do an evil act, which is against the law. But a child which has not gone against the law, we can't do anything. But however, God, when we're talking about God acting here, God has the right to do that. And now it says, the next Rashi says, it says, Es Haaretz. Es, the Haaretz means the land. Es doesn't have a meaning. Okay? But our sages interpret it. So Rashi says that there are two ways of translating the word Es. One is like min, from the earth. Okay? And he gives examples of where it means from. And then he says, Esar, it means Imar, it's with the earth. That for the three handbreadths of soil, of the depth of the plow, right? In other words, the depth of the blade of the plow, how deep it goes, was also dissolved and washed away. Okay, according to one, there are two interpretations of Esar, or S, and then the earth. One is from the earth. We were, all living flesh was removed from the earth, right? What means everything was destroyed with the earth, and with the earth means the depth of a plow. Okay, so the question is, what's the difference between these two answers? In Medrash Rabbah it says, even the earth acted incorrectly. Wheat was sown and was produced pseudo-wheat. But the pseudo-wheat we now find came from the age of the flood. Okay? So the thing is, Rashi is saying there's a difference of opinion about this Medrash. In other words, some people hold that the way we plowed, the way we planted, the way we did things destroyed the earth. So that is true. So that, just like we said, the animals that was used for their own self-interest, so the earth which they used through their control was also, so it also had to be destroyed. But according to the other opinion, that the earth wasn't destroyed, it was only the animal. Okay? Because it really says all flesh. It doesn't say the plant life. Doesn't say actually plant life. One of the commentaries says that it wasn't the plant life included. So the difference in Rashi is the difference in the two possibilities of Rashi is whether the plant life was also used for evil things, you see, and therefore they took away from where the plant life is the depth of the plow, or no, they didn't corrupt the earth. You understand? They only corrupted the animals, and God only killed the animals, so it was destroyed from the earth, not with the earth. Okay? But if you hold that the earth was also destroyed, then you hold that the earth also was corrupted by man, so then you have to say that the earth was also destroyed. That's two possibilities in the Rashi.